I love words. I took a course in college called etymology, which is the study of the root meaning of words, going back into the Latin or the Germanic origin of the word and so forth. I found a word in the Old Testament that appears 21 times that I think is very fascinating. It's the word Azer is spelled E-Z-A-R. It's pronounced Azer. It means to help. It means to succor. It means to provide aid or help or assistance. It's actually used 16 times out of the 21 times in referring to God being our helper. There's a very similar word that is spelled A-Z-A-R instead of E-Z-A-R, and it's pronounced Auser, that I believe is a more general help. It's like, you know, you and I would help each other. We'll go move the refrigerator, we'll cut the yard, or, you know, you'll help me with this, or I'll help you with that, and this type of thing. But this word, Azer, E-Z-A-R, is a fascinating word to me. It's not a general term. It's actually a militaristic term, a term that is applied to the military side, so to speak, of God. Strong's number 5828 says, Azer, it means to aid or help, to surround or protect or aid, to provide help, to succor. The primary idea lies in girdling or surrounding, hence defending or protecting. Azer is a military term that basically was used especially referring to in a time of war. Let me show you three scriptures real quick that bring this out. I don't want to go through all 16 where it talks about God and so forth. But in Exodus, the 18th chapter and verse 4, it says, Exodus 18 and verse 4, and the name of the other was Eleazar, for he said, the God of my fathers was my help, my Azer, E-Z-A-R, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So here in a time of battle, here in a time of war, God intervened, God surrounded him, God protected him, God enfolded him, as it were. He was his shield, and he protected him from Pharaoh. Also in Deuteronomy, the 33rd chapter, in verse 29, happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, a shield of your help, or Azer, again, and the sword of your majesty. Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. So very much used in a military sense of protection in times of hardship, in times like Bill Doss was talking about, in times of discouragement, in times of war, in times of problems and trials and tests, that God surrounds us, as it were, that he places hedges around us, that he places walls of protection to protect us. Then the third one I wanted to mention is in Psalms 20. He referred to Psalms quite a bit. Psalm 20 and verses 1 and 2. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble, and may the name of the God of Jacob defend you. May he send you help, or Azer, from the sanctuary, and strengthen you out of Zion. So perhaps we're beginning to see that this powerful word, this military term, referring to God as someone who you can rely on, someone that you can truly depend on, someone that you can put your life into their hands, that you can look to God for protection, to surround you, to help you. This word Azer is a very, very powerful term. It's a term that is not used lightly in the Bible. It's a term, like I said, that's used 16 times out of 21 referring to God. God doesn't stand in judgment of us. He doesn't stand in condemnation of us. He loves us. He protects us. He watches us. He sacrifices for us. God is there to support you. God is there to help you. Someone that you can depend on. Someone that you can rely on. Someone that you can put your whole life in his hands to protect you, that you can put your faith and your trust in his aid. It's used very much referring to so much to God that modern translators have actually, when new translations come out, want to translate this word Azer as mighty helper or highest help or helper. that because it does refer to God so much, they feel like it's such a powerful term. It's not like Ozer, that is just more general help, you know, one nation help another, or one family help another, or this type of thing. But that is a mighty help. It's a powerful help, a help that only comes from God. Over and over, the scriptures point out that God truly is our mighty helper, that our trust has to be in Him, that He is our shield, He is our buckler, He is the one that protects us. We put our trust, our faith in Him, that He fights for us, that He goes to battle for us, that He surrounds us and He protects us. Powerful, powerful word, this word Azer, this mighty military term implying fighting back to back, protecting one another, looking out for one's back, and so forth. It's a type of term that I think we men can probably gather in our brains maybe easier than a woman, because we like military things. You know, we like fighting and war and this type of thing. But this is a powerful, mighty, powerful term. And I know that all of us certainly take hope and knowledge and excitement about being protected by God, about God fighting for us, and certainly not against you. Well, Azer is used three other times in the scriptures, saying that Israel trusted in nations that could not provide that mighty help, that they had a false trust, they had a false hope, that they looked to false aid from other nations instead of trusting God, that they had this false trust and a false help. The same word appears two other times in the scriptures, where it applies actually to a human being. Now, when I learned this, my immediate thoughts was like was brought out in the sermonette about a powerful, mighty man of David. It doesn't refer to David. I think maybe about John the Baptist, you know, who Christ said no man was greater born of women than John the Baptist, or Samson or something like this. And you'd think it was describing some warrior type of man, you know, just a very strong, virile person like David was. Actually, I believe David came in contact with an Azer, but he himself was not labeled as such. Well, this individual is not labeled as an Azer either, because like I said, these are all the places where the word itself actually appears. But I think when we go through the passage, you perhaps will agree that truly the word Azer does apply to this individual. Well, maybe you've got your interest piqued up a little bit. I hope so, because truly you think of an Azer that this must be some powerful individual, a mighty person. But let's look at the two times that the word Azer appears where it does not refer to God or to Israel looking to false gods, in which in reality is referring again to God, that He is the only true mighty helper. Both times that the word occurs is found in Genesis, the second chapter, in verse 18 and verse 20. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper, an Azer, comparable to him." King James Version says, "I will make a help meet for him." Meet in Hebrew means as before him, or in other words, with him, part of him, and so forth. In Genesis, the second chapter, in verse 20, "So Adam gave names to all of the cattle and the birds of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found an Azer, a helper comparable to him." I was shocked that the only two times that the word Azer appears in the Bible referring to a human being as a mighty helper is referring to women, in this case specifically, to a woman, Eve, the mother of us all. 16 times the word refers to God directly as being an Azer. 3 times it refers to Israel looking to the wrong God for help and aid. And twice it refers to women being a mighty, powerful helper for her husband. Let's notice the passage that I was referring to about David meeting an Azer. In 1 Samuel, the 25th chapter, we read about a man whose name was Fool. He was an absolute idiot. And we read about his beautiful, gorgeous, outstanding Azer that was there to protect everyone around. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 2. Now again, the word Azer does not appear in this passage. We've covered the, we didn't go all the 16 times or the 3 times, but we've covered, where all of them are. But here it says in verse 2 of 1 Samuel 25. Now there was a man in Moab whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had more money than he had sense. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, and the man's name was Fool. Nabal. That's what Nabal means. It means fool, and he lived up to it. And the name of his wife was Abigail, which means my father is joy. She was a woman of good understanding and of beautiful appearance, had the rare combination like my wife has, of brains and beauty. But the man, Nabal, was harsh and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. Caleb means dog. So he came from a long line of scoundrels and sorry, good-for-nothing individuals. In verse 4, we find through verse 11 that David sent 10 of his men to help and protect them. They got out in the fields with the shepherds, and David then asked for some small assistance to be given to his men. This was very common back in that day. When you had armies that were going around the countryside, the only way that they had, unless they pillaged people, and of course David was not going to do that, the only way that they had to earn sustenance, the only way they had to earn any extra money or food in particular, was by serving the people. So armies would go and they would protect farms. While the shepherds were there, they didn't have to worry about wolves. They didn't have to worry about lions or anything. They didn't have to worry about people coming in and stealing their flock or anything like this. And David sent 10 men to protect all of this man's possessions. And David expected, as was common in that day, that his men would be paid for that. And so in verse 12, Nabal lived up to his name. He was an idiot. He was a fool. And he sent the king's servants away empty. And when they told David, David got so livid, he got so mad, because, it was his responsibility to make sure his army was fed, that they were taken care of, and that was David's responsibility as the king and as the ruler and as the leader. And so he was just absolutely livid, and he was going to go kill Nabal and everybody that was associated with him. So David grabbed his sword and 400 of his soldiers, and he went to slay Nabal and all of the men of the household, all of the servants. In verse 14, now when one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, but he reviled them. He's an idiot. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything, as long as they accompanied us. They didn't steal from us. They didn't pillage from us. They did not hurt us in any way. When we were in the fields, they were a wall to us, both by night and by day. Man, we slept the best we've slept in years. We felt protected. We didn't worry about anything because these guys were there just like this huge, powerful wall that provided protection for us both by night and by day. These guys apparently didn't sleep. They were diligent. They were on the job. And all of the time we were with them keeping the sheep. And in verse 17, now therefore know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master. And then they get it downright personal, and against all of his household. In other words, we're all going to die because of this idiot husband you've got. We've had it, for he is such a scoundrel that nobody can speak to him. You just can't. You can't talk to him. You can't reason with him. You can't discuss something on any kind of a level. He's just a nut. So Abigail made haste. She loaded up about 200 loaves of bread and a bunch of supplies and put it on donkeys. And she sent her servants ahead and said, I'll get the rest of it, and told them, I'll be right behind you. You go on. And but she did not say anything to her foolish husband. And so in verse 20, and so it was as she rode on the donkeys that she went down under cover of the hill. And there was David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all of this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed from all that belonged to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so, and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave even one male of all who belong to him by morning light. David was mad, and David was about to take revenge. In verse 23, now when Abigail saw David, she hastened to dismount from her donkey, and she fell on her face before David and bowed to the ground. A very strong, determined, humble woman. Powerful woman, submissive woman, a very wise woman, as we're going to see. So in verse 24, so she fell at his feet and said, on me, Lord, on me, let this iniquity be. You talk about the heart of a lioness. She said, I know you're mad. I know you're upset, and you have a right to be. Blame me. Please go ahead and kill me. I will take your revenge, but let my husband and all of his people live. So she fell at his feet and said, on me, my Lord, on me, let this iniquity be. Abigail was willing to put her life on the line for her sorry, good-for-nothing, worthless, sorry excuse of a husband idiot. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. He was a fool. Absolute idiot. So Abigail knew he was an idiot. She didn't deny that, and that he was actually a fool. But it's interesting, it doesn't say a lot about them, but you can kind of read in between here that she never called him that, that she didn't face him face to face, have knockdown drag outs, and all of this and that. Apparently Abigail treated her husband with respect, even though her husband did not deserve it, even though he had in no way, period, earned it. She definitely put his life above her own life and was willing to sacrifice herself for that sorry, good-for-nothing, worthless man. She was willing to fight for him, not fight against him. She then informed David that she actually was not involved in the incident and didn't know anything about it with David's men, but that she felt like that she could spare David from horrible bloodshed and bloodying his own hands. And then she gave the gifts to the young men that had come and protected their village and flocks and so forth that David had sent to Nabal. In verse 28, Abigail asked David to forgive her trespass. So she immediately placed the responsibility, she placed the wrong on herself, and she assumed the responsibility. Then she explained very tactfully and very wisely to David that he really did not want to kill Nabal and all of his household, that it would be better just to let God take care of it, which we're going to see that God did. So in verse 32, then David said to Abigail, blessed is the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who hath kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hastened to come to meet me, surely by morning light no males would have been left to Nabal. So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said unto her, go in peace to your house and see that I have heeded your voice and respected your person. Now that's quite a statement coming from a king. Kings normally don't make that kind of statement to common people. But it showed the absolute awe and respect that he had for Abigail. In verse 36, we find that Abigail went to Nabal, and he was very drunk, as the Bible puts it, putting on a feast like he was a king. He was playing a role and felt all vain and proud, and so he had this great big feast, and he wound up sot drunk. She went to talk to him, didn't say a word when she found out he was drunk. She had more sense and more wisdom than to do that. And so she didn't say anything to him that night. And so she waited until the next morning, and in verse 37, "So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, that his wife told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like stone. Then it came about after 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." So apparently he had a heart attack or a stroke and lived for 10 days. It upset him and scared him so bad when he thought about these 400 soldiers coming down to destroy them that God had vengeance upon him. So in verse 19, "So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept his servant from evil, for the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal to his own head.' And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, 'David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife.'" Notice her attitude in verse 41. "Then she arose and bowed her face to the earth and said, 'Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord.'" She'd just been offered a queenship to become David's wife. And yet she's down on her knees, willing to wash the feet of the servants that came to tell her that David wanted to marry her. Quite a woman, quite a woman. "Then she arose and..." So Abigail then rose in verse 42, "in haste." I think she was excited about being David's wife, especially after being married to such an idiot. "And rode on a donkey attended by 5 of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife." Abigail was a fighter. She was willing to take the blame. She was willing to put her life on the line. She was willing to take all of the retribution and responsibility on her shoulders and to die for that sorry, good-for-nothing husband of hers. Some of you women might say, "Yep, been there and done that." But you know, she fought with her wits. She fought with her intelligence. She fought with wisdom. She fought with humility. She fought with submission. She was a lady in every sense of the term, a lady of strength, a lady of courage, a lady that fought with humility and power. Her husband was an idiot, but instead of fighting her husband, she fought with him and she fought for him. She went to bat for him to literally save his life. But God saw to it, because of what he did, that she died. But she was a woman that was very sophisticated. She was sharp. She was intelligent. She was gracious and absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. She was a sharp woman who fought hard for her husband and for her family and for her loved ones. But she picked her battles. She knew and she realized that her battle was not with her husband. That's where she differs from many women today. She fought for him, even though he was an idiot, even though he lived up to his name. He was an absolute fool. He was a dog of a man. And even though he endangered her life and the life of everyone that was around there, yet she did not fight against him. She fought for him. Abigail had an inner strength, a depth of character that was there. She knew how to handle a fool, and she knew how to handle a king. She made quite an impression on David so much so that as immediately when her husband died, David sent and asked her to become his wife right away. He was very, very impressed with her. David had fought many armies, but he never fought any battle as sharp as Abigail was. Proverbs 31. Betty was telling me about a time when she was a teenager, what was that, 4 or 5 years ago, that they had a Bible study on Proverbs 31. And in preparation for the Bible study, that all of the teen girls were required to memorize Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31. She told me that the memorization and combined with the Bible study really made an impression on her as a young woman. It really helped her to understand and to see truly what a godly woman is to be like. She said as a teen that it helped her to have a role model in front of her. She pictured this lady as a tremendous role model, which I would say is great advice for all of the women, and especially the young women in the audience, to go through and to read Proverbs 31, because it's a powerful, powerful woman that does many things and it accomplishes many things that's discussed here in Proverbs 31. Certainly, Brittany and Paris and Lindsay are not role models, or should not be, today. But here we read about a woman that's willing to fight for her family, that's willing to work for her family, not work against her family, not fight against her family, but work with them. She surrounds them with blessings. She encompasses them with security. She enfolds them with love as we read through this. I'm not going to take time to mention anything, but I just wanted to read it, because this is a powerful tower of strength that we read about here, a quiet power and strength and patience. And you women would do well, I agree with my wife, to pattern your life and future life after this powerful lady. Proverbs 31 and verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts in her, so that he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil. All the days of her life she seeks wool and flax, and she willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night, and she provides food for her household and a portion for her maidens. She considers a field and she buys it. She perceives, and from her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp goes not out by night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff and her hand holds the spindle. She's not afraid of work. She extends her hand to the poor, very gracious, giving, loving person. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all of her household is clothed with scarlet. And she makes tapestry for herself, and her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates, and when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. And she shall rejoice in the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household, and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is passing. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now that is quite a woman. And I believe that's a description of an Azer, of someone who truly is a mighty helper, someone that succors, somebody that helps and aids and surrounds with a blanket of love and protection. I believe this woman is a go-getter. I think she's a fighter. She's a hard worker. She sounds like, to me, a well-oiled military type of machine that's organized, alert, powerful, capable, protective, and productive. Quite a woman that's described here. And, of course, the Hebrew word Azer does not appear in this passage, as we've already covered. And yet I think this is a description of an Azer, a military term meaning strength, help, aid, and support. This is a description of a woman who is willing to fight back to back with her husband, not fight against her husband. Some of you ladies want to fight, all right. Some of us have our swords drawn, but maybe we're fighting the wrong enemy. Every day that we fight against our loved ones, we yet nail another nail into the coffin of our marriage. In today's society, too many women are so busy criticizing their husbands, so busy trying to judge their husbands, so busy trying to change their husbands and condemning their husbands, so busy fighting with their husbands that they can't find a way to fight for them, to fight back to back with them, to surround them, to protect them, to embrace them, to help them, to aid them, to be a mighty helper for them. You know, it's the same with some teenagers. They receive very little praise, very little encouragement, nothing but fighting, nothing but warfare. Satan the devil is out to destroy your family. You know that, or at least I hope you know it. Satan is out to destroy your marriage. He would love to destroy your children. He would love to get at your husband. Satan hates families and everything that they stand for. Your husband, your family, is bombarded every single day by Satan the devil. Satan would love to destroy your mate. He would love to destroy your family. You need to wrap your arms around them. You need to enfold them. You need to protect them, to help them, to aid them and guide them and succor them. You need to comfort them and to fight for them, not against them. They're not your enemy. Satan, sin, is the enemy. And please take whatever steps are necessary, brethren, to keep Satan's influence away from your husband and away from your children. You can't buy a set of tires today, watching television and ads for them, without seeing hardly some bikini-clad, shapely gal up there, and what in the world she has to do with a set of tires, I have no idea. But these things affect the mind of your husband. They affect the mind of your children. Television shows. What's that, the Family Guy? I've never seen it, but I've seen ads for it, and I've heard things about it, where he's an absolute idiot. And the whole family is an absolute idiot. And we watch things like that, and it affects our children. Soap operas, and the garbage and the junk that's on television today, and it seduces the hearts and the minds of your families. Daughters think they have absolutely no value if they're 5 pounds overweight, if they're not some skinny, skin and bone thing that looks like a model walking down some runway somewhere, that they don't feel any self-worth, that they feel like, I'm not worth the salt that mother put on the roast tonight. I'm a worthless human being because they're not like so-and-so. We have to fight against that in our families. Do you blame or do you take countermeasures? Some teenagers feel like because they can't afford or their parents won't let them have the latest fashion trend, they're, again, they're worthless as a human being. They're embarrassed to go to school and this type of thing. Do you preach at, do you fuss at, or do you help and aid and guide and love all of your family? I think most women would admit that they have a tremendous difficulty forgiving. Probably we men have so many flaws and so many weaknesses and everything that maybe we can forgive one another easier. But I think most women, I've had a lot of women mention to me that they just have a hard time forgiving their husband because he did so-and-so or such-and-such. That is very difficult. Do you judge? Do you condemn? Do you preach? Do you fuss at? Or do you take the necessary steps to protect and to preserve your husband's love and your children's love and respect? Certainly, this is not the time nor the place to be too graphic in some areas. I think you understand what I'm talking about. But are you the best wife that you could be and should be? Are you the best mother that you could be and should be? Sometimes ladies get their military side all bent out of shape, and boy, they're really wound up and they're ready to go and fight, but they wind up fighting the wrong person, and they wind up fighting directly for Satan the devil by being against their mates instead of constructively fighting for their mates and being a security blanket that floods them with love and protection and engulfs them with strength and honor. Esther was quite a woman. In the book of Esther, because she was willing to put her life on the line and fight for her nationality, an entire nation of Jews that was going to be wiped out, she was beautiful. She was one of these drop-dead gorgeous women. She was humble. She was absolutely gorgeous. And yet she had an attitude of a servant. She was a fighter, and yet she was submissive. She was strong, and she was courageous. I think one of the things that I have loved about my wife for all these years, she has never understood how beautiful she really is. She's never known that. And I think Esther was a woman that we're going to see was a lot like that. Esther, the first chapter, we find that King Ahasuerus was king over 127 provinces, has this huge display of wealth for 180 days. He showed off his power and his great might, and then he capped it off with a gigantic feast that lasted for 7 days. And on the seventh day, after a lot of pretty heavy drinking, he wanted to show off his trophy wife, Vashti, because she also was drop-dead gorgeous. But Queen Vashti refused to come into the, quote, meat market, and she said, I'm not going to be used like that. I'm not going to be put on display before these drunken slobs. And so all of the king's advisors immediately, boy, they began to sober up, and they thought, wow, this could have catastrophic events and examples through all of the women in the kingdom. In Esther 1 and verse 16, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, they said, but also the princes and all of the people who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. And when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to come to be brought before him, and she did not come. So this very day in verse 18 of Esther, the first chapter, this very day, of the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say that the king's officials, that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. And it's true. They didn't say something that was wrong, because this is what we face today. And so they said, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be changed. Anything that was written by the king's hand, sealed with his signet ring, was of the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Even the king could not change it. Once it was made law, it was law. And nobody, including the king, the one that made the law, had the authority to change it. So let this be part of the law of the Medes and the Persians, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And when the king's decree, which he has made, is proclaimed throughout all of the empire, for it is great, all wives then will honor their husbands, both small and great. So in Esther, the second chapter, we find that King Ahasuerus gets lonesome, and he wants his wife. He misses his wife. So the seven advisors get together and they say, okay, why don't you do this? Let's go through all of the kingdom and let's pick out some of the most gorgeous, beautiful, talented, sweet virgins that we have, the sexiest looking ones, to be the wife and queen for King Azarias. He narrowed the list down once they chose them, and then the chosen ones were sent seclusion for a year to be trained. They were there 12 months to be trained to become a queen. You don't just wake up one morning and know how to be a queen. It takes a lot of training. You have to learn about dignitaries and heads of state and a lot of different protocol and so forth, how to conduct yourself. So these individuals were taken, and for 12 months they were trained. And then at the end of that year's preparation, the king then chose Esther to become his wife, to become the new queen. Now at this point, nobody knew that Esther was a Jew. Mordecai was her uncle. Uncle Mort was actually the one who was raising Esther. Now the plot thickens. Two of the king's advisors were hatching a plot to kill the king. Well, good old Uncle Morty found out about it, and he told Esther, and she told the king, and the king hung the two bad guys. And the king had all good intentions that he wanted then to be able to reward Mordecai, but it kind of slipped his mind, other things happened and so forth, and so he didn't reward him. So these two guys got hung. Then wicked Haman buddies up to the king, and he becomes the second in charge. He gets all kinds of promotions. He gets the authority right underneath the king, so much so that he even wears the king's signet ring. And everyone bowed and scraped before Haman, and he was really carried away with himself. Everybody, that is, except good old Uncle Morty. He couldn't stand him, and Haman could not stand Mordecai. Burned Haman up because he wouldn't bow and scrape to him. And so he made his mind up to have Mordecai killed, and not only that, all of his people, all of the Jews, killed. In Esther 3 and verse 12. So Haman wrote a decree and he signed it in the king's name and he sealed it with the king's signet ring. And in verse 13, and the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all of the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And a copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they would be ready for that day. Then in Esther 4, we find that it was a great time of mourning. I mean, they were down, and it's understandable that the Jews were upset. They knew they were going to die. And Mordecai sat in the city gates with sackcloth and ashes, which was against the law. He could have been arrested and he could have been killed just for doing that alone. But good old Uncle Mort told Esther she had to do something about it. And I'm sure Esther thought, who, me? Well, what am I supposed to do? How can I do something? You know, I'm just one person. And but the way it was escalating, Mordecai told her as the queen that even she would not be safe, and it would be brought out that she was a Jew and that she would be killed. So in verse 10, Esther sent word to good old Uncle Mordecai that the law stated that if anyone went before the king without being summoned or without being called, that they would automatically be killed unless the king would hold out a golden scepter. And Esther made it plain known that I have not been called. Verse 13. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape the king's palace any more than all the other Jews are in the king's palace. For if you remain completely silent at this, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews. Mordecai had faith in God that he truly was the mighty helper and deliverer and protector. So he said, help is going to arise, but lady, it's in your lap. You are responsible. from another place, but you and your father's house will perish if you don't do something. Yet who knows whether you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this? You know, he said, maybe God just worked this out for you to be there at this time so that you will be the Savior of the Jewish nation. Then Esther told him in verse 15, told them to reply to Mordecai, go and gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, fine, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So Esther was willing to put herself and her life in front of the lion of death to protect her family and to protect her nation. In Esther 5, after fasting for 3 days and three nights, she donned her queenly garments and she went to see the king. This probably was one of the most tense moments in the history of mankind. Because if the king did not accept her, she was dead and all of the Jews would have been wiped out. So the history of mankind here, as it were, hung in the balance because of this one lady. Not only did she have to be accepted, she had to come up with a pretty good plan, a brilliant plan that would reverse the fate of the Jews. So she throws a big banquet. He did accept her, and she said, I'd like to honor you and Haman, because he was the second guy. And so Haman was floating on cloud nine. He thought, oh, wow, I've got it good in with the queen now, and man, I've got it made. So he was just so excited and went home and told everybody and this and that. But Mordecai was a thorn in his flesh. Could not stand it. Haman's wife and all of his friends said, why don't you just get rid of this guy? Just kill him, you know. Let's get this thing over with. Build some gallows and hang the buzzard. And so he did. He built the gallows 50 feet high. Esther 6, King Azarias had a bad night. Apparently heartburn, indigestion. He couldn't sleep. So he thought some reading might make him sleepy. So they brought the book of the records of the Chronicles, which was read to him. Now that sounds like that would put you to sleep. That's kind of like listening to a sermon, the book of the record of the Chronicles. How thrilling can you get? But you know, that's the difference between being a king. When you and I can't sleep, we get up and we read. When the king can't sleep, he gets up and they read to him. But anyway, so he gets up and they go through the book of the record of the Chronicles. Sound like it worked pretty good to me to put you to sleep. And his memory was jarred when he got to the point about Mordecai and about the individuals that had plotted and planned his death. And so he thought, you know, I don't think I ever did anything for Mordecai. I need to do that. So Haman was there, and he thought, okay, let me ask Haman what would be a good thing to do for this guy that needs to be praised and shown honor to. And so he asked wicked Haman, and of course with his vanity, Haman thought it was him. When he said, you know, I want to honor somebody, what should I do? And so, man, he let his imagination run rampant. He said, get your best stallion, the king's horse itself, and you get your best priest, kingly robes, and you put on him, you put his signet ring on his hand and so forth, and parade him through the whole streets that everybody can look on him. What a great and fantastic man this was. And he could just visualize it in technicolor. He could see himself on that white stallion going down the street and everybody bowing and praising to Haman. And when King Nebuchadnezzar, listen to me, Azarias told him that it was Mordecai, he just about passed out. I mean, he couldn't even talk. Just hard to breathe. He thought, my bitterest enemy? And I have told the king to do this and that for him. Well, Azarias told him to go and do this very thing that he had mentioned for Mordecai instead of himself. Then in Esther 7, on the second day of the banquet, Esther revealed then that there was a plot to kill her and her family and all of her people, the Jews. In verse 5 of Esther 7, so King Azarias answered and said unto Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, and who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" Because he didn't know anything about this. Haman had written a letter, signed the letter with the king's name, and used the signet ring to destroy all of the Jews. And Esther said in verse 6, "The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen, if you can imagine. Then the king arose from his wrath of the banquet of wine, and he went into the palace garden. He was so mad he had to get out. I got to take a walk. Man, this can't be true that this has gone on under my nose. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life. He was like a little scared chicken. For he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And when the king returned from his palace garden to the palace of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Bad move. Then the king said, "Will he also assault my queen while I'm in the house?" And as the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And now Habana, one of the eunuchs, said unto the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good of the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." And then the king said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman and the gallows that were prepared for Mordecai. And then the king's wrath subsided. Then in Esther 8, verse 1, "On the day the king Azarias gave Queen Esther the house of Haman and the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king as Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring that he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai and Esther, and appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king and fell down at his feet and implored him with tears," showed a tremendous amount of humility, tremendous amount of grace, a tremendous amount of self-subservience, that she wasn't vain and proud and puffed up. She fell at his feet and with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. Then in verse 6, she said, "How can I endure to see this evil thing that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" And since this law was the law of the Medes and the Persians, even the king could not reprimand or change or reverse the law. So he told them, he said, "You put your heads together, you write a letter, whatever you come up with, we'll send it to you, put the signet ring on it, put my signature on it, and we'll send it to all the provinces to be able to free your people, whatever we can come up with." And so by these letters, the king permitted the Jews, in verse 11 of Esther 8, permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together to protect their lives, to destroy and kill and annihilate all of the forces of any people or provinces that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. So this is quite a brilliant thing. They couldn't change the law that they were to be killed, so they said, "Okay, then you stand together and you fight." And that'll scare everybody off, and sure enough, it did. They weren't willing to come and kill the Jews like they had planned on in the beginning. But wow, what a lady. This lady was a fighter. She was ultra, ultra feminine, emotional, caring, beautiful, submissive, highly intelligent. She was sophisticated. She was educated. She was passionate about everything that she set her hand to do. And God used her to save an entire nation of people. Can God use you as a woman to save your husband, to save your children, to save your family? One final example I want to give, and then I'll be quiet. And this is actually found outside the Bible. I've entitled it "The Wives of Weisenberg," Weinsberg in German. W is pronounced as a V, Weisenberg. In the Middle Ages, in the year in Germany of 1141, Wolf, who was a Duke of Bavaria, was besieged inside of his castle walls, Weissenburg, by an army led by Frederick and his brother, the Emperor Conrad. Wolf was not going to surrender. He said, "I'll fight to the end. I will not give up." Conrad was indignant and mad because Wolf was making quite a siege out of it and extended it and cost him more money and men and everything else. So he sent word to the inhabitants and he said, "Unless you surrender at once, I will demolish your city, burn your buildings, and put all of the inhabitants to the sword." Well, that brought a lot of fear and trembling inside. But they came back with a defiant and indignant challenge and said, "We will not surrender." So the siege continued for some period of time. And at last, Weissenburg was compelled to yield. The Duke realized that they just could not hold out, that they were going to have to go ahead and submit. So Emperor Conrad was now really mad because this siege had gone on, cost him a lot of money, cost him several lives and so forth. So he was more determined than ever that his original threat was going to be carried out and that everybody would be killed and the city burned and destroyed. So when this message was sent inside the city walls, again, it was a loud cry and lamentation because they were scared and they were filled with terror. So they gathered together an ambassador's group, and they sent this group of people to Conrad to try to reason with him. And they said, when they went in the camp, they said, "We men of Weissenburg are not afraid of your threat, and we're willing to submit to the fate of war." In other words, we're going to die. We know that. That's fine. We will take that. We have tried to withstand you. We no longer can withstand you. That's it. We're going to die. "You may burn our buildings and destroy our towns if you will, but we beg you to spare our women." Conrad replied with this, "I have sworn an oath that your city will be destroyed and your people shall be put to death. But it is not for me to make war against helpless women. Therefore, I will spare their lives. Furthermore, you may tell them that on the morrow, each of them may carry away on their shoulders whatever precious possession she may deem worthy of preservation. I do not wish to leave them destitute upon the world." So that's a nice gesture. You know, he said, "You can carry your jewels and all this and that, because you're going to lose your husband, you're going to lose your mate, and so I don't want you just left absolutely destitute." Now, when the Duchess of Weissenburg heard this, she called all the women together in the market square. She told the men to go to another part of the town that she wanted to talk to these women. She reached over to the lady next to her and she whispered in her ear. The lady smiled. And she reached over and whispered in the ear of the next lady. She reached over and whispered in the ear of the next one and so forth until every woman there knew what was in the heart and in the mind of this duchess. And each one then smiled and they departed and went on their way. The next morning, when the gates were open, the Emperor Conrad stood outside to watch the women file by, each one with her precious possessions. First one out the gate was the Duchess. And to the astonishment of the Emperor and to all of the army that was standing around there, the admiration, the Duchess was bearing upon her shoulders her husband. The Duke. It was the very first one that the Duke had sworn to put to death by the sword. Following her came a long line of women, each one bending and struggling under the burden of their husband or some dear relative. As the Duchess passed the Emperor, she said, "We have your word, my lord, that we can bear safely away that which we consider to be the most precious, and each of us has taken her soldier husband. You are welcome to what is left in the city." The Emperor's chagrin was completely totally, instantly changed to absolute admiration. The earnest faces of the women that were all turned to him with their husbands on their backs, he looked at them and he changed his mind altogether. He looked toward the city and turning to the women who were struggling along with their husbands, he said unto them, "You may rid yourselves of your heavy but precious burden and freight. I shall harm none of you because you deserve to keep the treasure that you have borne." Then he called all of the men and the women to him and told them that he not only was going to spare them, but also the whole city from the sword and from the fire. Thus did the women of Weisenberg save their husbands and save their castle and save their town. The Castle Mount after that became known as the Hill of Weiberthreu, which means woman's fidelity. Mark H. Creech said about this example, "There has never been a time in the history of our nation when there was a greater need for women like the wives of Weisenberg. Some might accuse me of being of a fanciful language and exaggeration, but I say that America's fate rests squarely on the backs of its wives and mothers. Once more, we need wives of Weisenberg to rise up and to show that few positions in life are as demanding as the wife and the mother. She sacrifices to make her home attractive and to do the laundry and to cook the food and to care for the children and care for her husband's personal needs. Nevertheless, her sacrifices give her life a depth and dignity that cannot come in any other way. Moreover, the very fate of the nation rests upon her shoulders, upon how well she performs her unique, incomparable role in life. She, in many respects, is the hope of the nation." There's a quote from a famous play that says, "The wife and mother in her office holds the key to the soul, and she stamps the coin of character and makes the being who would be a savage but for her gentle cares a Christian man or woman, then crown her the queen of the world." I hope this sermon has given you some food for thought of truly what it means to be a helpmeet, of what it means to be an Azer. Actually, you women are living now the example of what all of us, both men and women, are going to be living in the upcoming kingdom of God. For in doing so, we are going to be for all eternity the bride of Jesus Christ, the Azer, the helper of Jesus. Ladies, I stand in absolute awe of you.